We got a break from our weekend storm, by and large. The winds were not what had been forecast, and the damage far less than we were bracing for. But as Hurricane Matthew demonstrated recently, there are plenty of times we expect the worst, and nature delivers. We can only prepare so much. But is that necessarily true? We can batten down the hatches where we are, but how about not actually having those hatches in those places? We get a broader view of how we prepare for the disaster, or don't, in Robert Muir Wood's book, The Cure for Catastrophe. Robert Muir Wood does this for a living. He's chief research officer at the company Risk Management Solutions. He's also a visiting professor at the Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction at University College London. Robert is the author of several other books and the founding editor of the magazine Terra Nova. Robert Muir Wood, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's you. Good morning.
So I can imagine risk management is never unbusy. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, we're either dealing with the aftermath of events which have just happened, so we are still providing background information for Hurricane Matthew and Hurricane Nicole, which hit Bermuda last week, and if there hasn't been a recent event, then we are busy researching and trying to learn what we can do to help reduce the impact of disasters which have yet to happen.
And it appears you get into this line of work through our side of the table, through journalism. What intrigued you as a journalist about disasters?
Well, I was a scientist and a journalist, I have to say. So I was a kind of a science writer early on, and I was doing earth sciences originally, and I got intrigued by what one can learn if you go and study a disaster in the aftermath, how you can learn why it happened, where it happened, what controlled the fact that some buildings are damaged, others are untouched, where people died, where people survived. There's a huge amount which can be learned if you actually take apart, if you do the forensics of a disaster, and we've been doing that now for 25 years or so, and actually out of that learning, there are lots and lots of lessons, some which have been applied and others which have still to be applied, but all of which can help reduce the consequences of the next big earthquake or the next big storm along the Oregon coast or hurricane along the East Coast whenever it comes.
Well, and among the lessons that have not been applied, you quote a geologist saying that we could erase earthquakes from the list of human scourges, and he said that back in 1944.
He did, yeah, and I mean that is still true. I mean that was a very prescient thing to say. That was by a young geologist in Argentina after a big earthquake had hit that country, and it is true. If we made it a priority, we know how to build buildings which don't fall down in earthquakes. You know, there's nothing really new about that, but actually, it's the application. It's the fact that most of the time, People don't do the right thing, or they think it's going to cost an extra few thousand dollars, so they don't build the building strong enough. And by doing that, we are creating the future risk. We're creating the buildings which are going to fall down and kill people in the future. There's nothing new about how to solve the problem. It simply comes down to application.
Is it often money? I mean, because the first simple question of the day would seem to be, why don't we avoid disasters better?
Well, it is sometimes argued to be money. I mean, if a builder is building many many houses across Florida or many many houses across San Francisco, they will typically like to do it as cheaply as they can, around the world. In many countries, we have building codes now, and the building codes actually tell you how you should be building your house or your office block. But actually, builders quite often like to try and get around them. I mean, in the U.S., that's difficult. They may simply argue for a simplified version. In a lot of countries, the building inspector is someone you take out for a cup of coffee and get him to sign a document in exchange for a little bit of money. There's a lot of corruption which goes on in poorer countries around builders actually cutting corners, so they don't do the right thing.
And are they often not held liable when something goes wrong, if a building collapses and it wasn't supposed to in an earthquake?
Well, yeah, I mean, in many developing countries, no one is held liable. I mean, in a wealthy country, they might be held liable. I mean, a very good example I describe in my book is the country of Chile, which actually is sort of more hit by big earthquakes than probably any other equivalent country. I mean, as much as Japan, more than California, and they really have created a great building code there, and every builder knows that it's quite likely that if a building falls, you know, that they have so many earthquakes, a building is going to be tested in the next 10 or 20 years. If the building falls down, the builder will be sent to jail for up to 10 years, and that's common knowledge, and actually builders don't cut corners there.
Wow. You do write a very short and simple phrase, disasters are political. What does that mean?
Well, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean, they become political for many reasons. I mean, one reason is they set the agenda. If you are a government in power and you think you're doing quite well, and suddenly you have a big earthquake or you have Hurricane Katrina flooding the whole city of New Orleans, that then becomes the agenda, and you are going to be expected to respond politically to that. It has many impacts which will have political consequences. I mean, it will have destroyed a lot of buildings, which people feel, even though they may not have insurance, they may feel someone owes them some money for them. But in setting the agenda for governments, I mean, we find situations where governments have been brought down by disasters. I mean, there's a famous example in China in 1976 when they had a massive earthquake which largely destroyed a city quite close to the capital, Beijing. And that earthquake effectively brought down what was called the Cultural Revolution at that time, and actually set China on the path to its modern prosperity. You can take it back to an earthquake. Wow. In that kind of way.
All right. Much more to talk about with Robert Muir Wood about how disasters can be political, but also how we just don't prepare for them as much as we potentially could. The Cure for Catastrophe is his book. Back with Robert Muir Wood and you on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the risk management expert Robert Muir Wood. His book is called The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It's not that we make the disasters, but we certainly make the capability for the disasters to really harm us. And we're getting into why and how. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your observations about how we prepare for disasters or don't. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of case histories, a lot of good studies in the book. And one of the figures that you talk about here is Toshitaka Katada. He was a civil engineering professor in Japan. Which disasters inspired him?
Well, this Professor Katada, he went to the areas impacted by the great tsunami in the Indian Ocean, which happened in the day after Christmas in 2004, and he was struck by the fact that a lot of people could have escaped before the tsunami hit, but they didn't. They stayed in their buildings, waiting for someone to tell them what to do. And so he went back to Japan, and he decided to try and teach the children at the schools in a single city on the Pacific coast of Japan, and which he did for a couple of years. He taught them his sort of rules, which were don't trust the official new information. Take your own initiative. Escape if you can, and other people will follow you. On the day in March 2011, when the great earthquake hit along the Japan coast, his children at schools actually followed the lessons they learned from him, and no child in this city, no child who was at school that day died, while about 1,000 people in this town actually were drowned. And so this was very, very successful. He taught them to set an example, to run up the hill, and the other children joined them in this procession.
So just get out fast. Don't wait for instructions.
Don't wait for anybody. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, and yet, it seems like Japanese culture has so much experience with earthquakes and tsunamis that sort of instruction wouldn't have been necessary.
Well, I think in Japan, people are very, very used to receiving instruction, and it is just the way the society is. And so, you know, to tell people to take your own initiative to tell children was actually quite a radical thing to do. I mean, this could also apply along the coast of Oregon too, that where there is the potential one day to have a very, very big earthquake. The last time it happened was in 1700, and actually people then may wait for instruction, but the message is you need to get out, you need to move to higher ground, and actually not wait for someone to tell you to do that.
And I don't know if you were aware, it probably happened after this book went to press, but Oregon State University followed through with a decision to build onto the Hatfield Marine Sciences Center in Newport, Oregon, which is within the tsunami zone.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so which raises the question, not just for Oregon, but for Japan and any other place that is prone to tsunamis, too, is that I remember reading in The New Yorker years ago about old markers from centuries ago where previous cultures had warned, this is how high the water came, don't build beyond this point, and yet the Fukushima nuclear plant was built beyond that point.
Yeah, I mean, that is the case. I mean, these markers, I mean, they go back in China, they go back more than 2,000 years on the rivers, and they're a wonderful thing to, a wonderful message to send the future, to sort of warn people about what can happen. In Japan, they put them along the coast, marking how far inland the big tsunamis had gone. I mean, the coast which was hit at Fukushima itself, where the nuclear power plants, was a little bit further south of the area which had been affected by two earlier tsunamis in the previous 100 years or so. But as you say, the whole Fukushima story is another tragic story where people thought it was okay to build nuclear power plants along that coast. They built 14 altogether because they believed that it was somehow protected and it wasn't hit by the biggest earthquakes. And increasingly, information had been found that there had been a giant earthquake and tsunami about 1,100 years ago, but actually the operators of the nuclear power plants didn't really want to know about it, and then it happened again, and they weren't prepared, and they lost three of the reactors in meltdown.
Robert Muir Wood is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Cure for Catastrophe. You also list, after talking about Japan, the progression of flood events in New Orleans over the years. Were the defenses that were built at the time of Katrina, for example, adequate for the last storm but not the next one?
Well, it's what tends to happen after a flood is that it becomes possible to argue to people that we should spend some money on building a flood defense. I mean, everybody will agree after a flood happens, we should build a flood defense to prevent that event happening again, and then a little bit more. And the question is how much higher you build it. And but the problem is the city of New Orleans is sinking. So you build the flood defenses, and then it becomes very hard to argue that the flood defenses are built any higher at all if you haven't just had a flood, because people think the money should be spent on schools or better transport or something else. And then so almost inevitably the next flood is sort of programmed in as a result of the fact that the defenses from the previous flood are getting lower and lower each year, eventually the city floods again. And actually, now $14 billion has been spent on building fantastic flood defenses around New Orleans. And for now, the city is fairly safe. But a big question comes in 50 years' time. Are people going to think it's worth spending more money on flood defenses, or will they leave the defenses, and in which case, eventually, the city will be flooded again?
So what is the cliff edge effect you refer to in this portion of the book, The Cure for Catastrophe?
Well, the cliff edge, I mean, the term cliff edge is a term one uses around some sort of process which shows sort of very gradual change, and then you suddenly reach a point, and just like falling off a cliff, you walk along the top of the cliff and it's fairly flat, you take one more step, you've fallen over the cliff, you drop down. It's called a cliff edge effect, and actually something which has a cliff edge effect is a flood defense, a flood wall. So you build a flood wall, and as long as the water doesn't rise up to the top of the flood wall, you're completely protected. You're completely dry. But if it rises, just a foot higher, then the whole city beyond the flood wall is going to be flooded. And that's what we call a cliff edge effect. This is suddenly huge consequence with just a small change. And that is a big problem for people who may live behind flood walls, who typically assume they're going to be safe. In this town in Japan, where the children's lives were all saved, there were tsunami flood walls, but they hadn't been built high enough, and a lot of people lived behind the flood walls, and they assumed if the government was going to build them a flood wall, they must know what they were doing. They would guarantee to be protected, but they weren't. So it's a problem that we encourage. If you build a flood wall, people come and live behind it, and then when the water overtops the flood wall, the consequences may be larger than if you hadn't built the wall in the first place.
So more people may be affected because they chose to move next to a place they thought was safe.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. Robert Muir Wood is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It has a lot to do with how we place ourselves in the pathway of danger fairly often. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your phone calls and emails are welcome. Some questions or comments for Robert, or maybe some stories of your own about disasters you've been caught in. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. So here in the United States, we have a conflict of interest between the counties that collect money for building permits and property taxes and us federal taxpayers that bail out the homeowners after their place has been destroyed. So in other words, the counties have a lot of incentive, you know, to let people build in flood areas, in forest fire areas, in landslide areas, and they don't receive, you know, any deficit from when the catastrophe happens, and then the federal government, in other words, us federal taxpayers, mm-hmm. bail out the loss.
All right, so they want the high income that comes from the beachfront property, for example, and then the rest of the country has to rebuild that.
Bill and I call those tsunami estates.
Tsunami estates. Thanks for that, Ann. Appreciate it. Robert, thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a very, very common problem that we are busy creating new risk. If risk was something you could see, if it was painted bright yellow and you could see when it was happening, you know, that would be really helpful. The problem is that we just see new buildings going up, and we don't immediately think this is risk, and this is, you know, bad things are going to happen to it, and the people to whom it happens are going to probably expect someone else to bail them out. And we need to connect. We need to connect it right back so that we get people to understand why it is to their benefit not to build things in harm's way. And I mean, you have to start at some point not bailing people out. If the decision was taken 50 years ago, that's obviously a little difficult. But if they've taken a decision in the last few years to build something in harm's way, they should expect to compensate themselves for the consequences. They shouldn't expect everybody else to bail them out.
Is there any place in the world that draws a line and says if you build beyond this point, you're on your own?
Well, I mean, there are places which, one place I mentioned in my book is in the Bahamas. They have the same hurricanes as in Florida. It's very low-lying, and the government completely ignores requests to bail people out. And so there's a famous canal estate on Grand Bahama, which has been flooded so many times you can't get insurance for houses there anymore. So if you can't get insurance, you can't get a bank loan. So the houses have started to become abandoned. But at the same time, some people discover that if you build your house on concrete stilts 10 feet off the ground, you can, you know, it's out of reach of the floods, and you can bring it back to being insured. The insurers will offer coverage again. You can get a bank loan. So if they worked out how to solve the problem, how to reduce the risk, and the government just has no interest in actually in helping people who it thinks. I think that they made the decision they should rue the consequence.
We have an email here from Randy in Rouge, Oregon. He writes, "Seems like the reason we don't plan for disasters in a comprehensive way is the same reason modern corporations only plan for the bottom line for the next quarter rather than the next decade. Similar short-term thinking. Kick the can down the road a bit and hope for the best." Randy in Rouge wrote that. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, Robert?
I think Randy, you have you've hit the problem that we think short-term. We sort of cross our fingers and hope that the bad thing doesn't happen, you know, in the next few years. I mean, if you're a builder, I mean, once you've sold that building on, then you don't feel responsible anymore. I mean, we need to go back to the idea that actually a builder always maintains responsibility for what they built. I mean, for 10 years and more, and yeah, it's only by a community understanding, you know, as Anne said, I mean, a community understanding that actually it's to the benefit of the whole community that they don't allow people to build in harm's way, and then you know, they will save money overall, and in particular if someone who does build in harm's way, you are going to have to face them with a situation that they're not going to get bailed out.
Let's take another call. Here is Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Muir Wood, the author of The Cure for Catastrophe.
Good morning. It's so refreshing to see something in this subject area that isn't doom porn. It's a wonderful thing. My two questions, one, what are your observations on Fukushima? And then secondly, why aren't we hardening the grid against collapse, either EMP collapse, solar collapse, things like that? I understand it would take a pittance in the greater scheme of things regarding our infrastructure to do this. Why isn't this happening? Or at least, what are your observations on that? I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay. Actually, thank you for, I mean, my book is, I mean, I think it's sort of measured and moderately optimistic about what we can do. So you're right. I'm glad it's not in the doomsday literature. So you mentioned two things. I mean, I already said something about Fukushima. I mean, it was built the first of the nuclear power plants at Fukushima was planned before the theory of plate tectonics existed. So right back in the early 60s, and at a time when they just thought, because they hadn't had a big earthquake there for a couple of hundred years, that it was actually completely safe. So a very poor outcome, which the nuclear industry tended to defend things. Even as new science arrived, they had so much invested along that coast, they actually would tend not to take on board new information. The second point you mentioned was around hardening the grid and the threat of electromagnetic pulse events,
and solar interruptions,
or solar flares. There has been a lot of work in a number of countries. I mean, I've been to a number of meetings on this, and across Europe now, a lot of work has gone on in Sweden and in Finland and the northern countries, which are most at risk, in Canada too. So the U.S., there is some work now going on. It is quite belated. I mean, the risk is clearly is too high to be acceptable. I mean, a big event may only happen once every few hundred years, but actually the consequences look extremely serious in terms of actually taking out high voltage transformers and actually leading to weeks or months of power outages, which is an outcome which is completely intolerable to people and to governments. I mean, I think that a government would be hard for it to maintain its authority if two or three states are going for a few months without any power.
No doubt. I want to come back to some of the historical portions of the book the idea that people once rang church bells to ward off a natural occurrence. What were they doing?
This goes back to medieval time in Europe, and I mean, it was at a time when people assumed that actually bad things, big disasters, catastrophes, they had to be interventions from the gods or from God in some way, and they must be punishing us in some form. And in medieval Europe, they took that a stage further and thought that that lightning was the work of demons, and the idea emerged. It's not quite clear where it came from, but if you rang church bells, you could drive off the lightning demons. You could make thunderstorms turn away. And so in the 16th and 17th centuries, the villagers would run to the church when they first heard a thunderstorm over the horizon. They'd run to the church and start ringing the bells as loudly as possible to try and drive away the storm. And until someone in the late 18th century, someone in France actually started collecting data on this and discovered that actually a number of these people who were ringing the bells had been killed by being struck by lightning because they were high up in the church tower and they were pulling on wet ropes and metal bells. And so this was about the most dangerous thing you could do. And eventually in France, they actually had to ban the activity because it was just considered too risky.
It took law to stop that. That's amazing. The book is called The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It's about how we take on a lot more risk than we need to. Robert Muir Wood is a risk management person. We'll come back and talk more with him about his book and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Robert Muir Wood, who's Chief Research Officer at the company Risk Management Solutions. He's also visiting professor at the Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction at University College London. So we are indeed talking about disasters and risks. And Robert's new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We've had a couple of interesting comments already. We welcome yours as well on the subject of disasters and the risks we take. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And we're just talking about ringing the church bells to drive away the demons that bring the lightning and the thunder. And we can chuckle about that, but the fact is that don't insurance policies today still refer to acts of God?
They do indeed, yeah. I mean, so we still have this idea with us that's somehow we are being punished in some way. We have to work out why. I mean, the word disaster has an interesting origin. It comes from the Italian root or the Latin root. It means a bad star. So the aster is like in astronomy, and it with the idea being that if you had some sort of bad star out there, which is probably a comet of some kind, that means a disaster is coming to Earth. And not because the comet hits, but simply because there's somewhere in the heavens, it's ordaining that a disaster is going to happen on Earth.
Evidently, in thinking of the modern period of approaching disasters and catastrophes, 1755 is considered catastrophe year zero. Why that year, Robert?
Well, it's in 1755, there was a massive earthquake at the fourth largest city in Europe, which was Lisbon, in the capital of Portugal. It was completely unexpected. It happened at 10 o'clock in the morning on one of the holiest days of the year, on All Saints' Day, November the 1st. It caused catastrophic damage. I mean, not only in that city, but other cities in southern Portugal. It caused a tsunami, then the city went on fire. And to the people at the time, it seemed just completely extraordinary. I mean, I think there are some parallels even with 9/11 as to how people received this information. It was just completely inconceivable that this could have happened, that such a wealthy, prosperous, famous, very religious city should have been destroyed in this way. And it set in motion the idea that you could use science to understand disasters and maybe with that understanding could be turned into action to reduce their consequences. It was born in the aftermath of the great Lisbon earthquake of 1755. So that's, you know, after that, the science agenda, which is what I wanted to write about, it emerged from people realizing the old way of assuming you're being punished by the gods, it didn't work. There had to be a science way of making sense of this and protecting ourselves against future disasters.
And in fact, if I read this correctly, that there was a prediction by the religious authorities that there would be a repeat on the one-year anniversary?
Yeah, no, I mean, a year, the city was in terrible shape. I mean, it was just in ruins for some time, and So and there was still the idea that actually there was a point of view. There was a religious figure in Lisbon who went around saying, "Look, you think this is just natural? No way. We were being punished. The city was being punished because the people are decadent and irreligious." And he said, "Look, and he made a prediction that exactly a year to the day after the earthquake, another great earthquake would come, and the people were consumed with fear because they didn't know who to believe. And I mean, they eventually, no one was allowed to leave the city for a few days before this repeat date, and eventually they calmed things down, and the big earthquake didn't happen. But it's sort of it is an indication of the kind of hysteria that went through the place as no one knew who to believe.
The stories that you tell in here of the beginnings of understanding of what happens in the world in natural disasters are quite compelling. Tell us about William Redfield, for example, and what he added to storm science in the 19th century.
Well, one of the challenges of catastrophes is that first of all, they're very rare, and second, they're very big, so they're very hard things to get a handle on, to study. And actually, this story of William Redfield is an interesting one, in that he was at the time a storekeeper on the Connecticut River. And so he had no particular interest in science or the atmosphere or anything. But he experienced a big hurricane. Actually went straight over him in September, I think, 1821. And at the same time, as he had a terrible tragedy that his wife died giving birth to a baby, consumed by this, he set off to walk across country to her parents, who lived in the south west corner of Massachusetts. And in order to do that, he was walking across the area which had been hit by this hurricane. And actually, he started noticing all the trees were blown down in a single direction. But then he got close to his destination, and suddenly the trees were being blown down in the opposite direction. And he realized from this that he had the idea that the storm, the hurricane winds, must be they must be going around in a circle. There must be a circular wind field. So he was really the first person to collect observations of the structure of a wind of the wind field of a hurricane. And he then hit on the idea of using the logs from ships' captains who had been through this hurricane when it was further south, but because they would write down every hour or so what the direction and speed of the wind was, and he used that to reconstruct the whole path of this hurricane until it hit the coast of New England. And so he became a great expert on hurricanes simply as a result of this experience.
That's impressive, using big data in the 1820s.
Yeah.
So hurricanes, you can at least see them approach to some degree. How long before earthquake science, for example, caught up with what Redfield was doing and his companions on hurricanes?
Yeah, it took a while. I mean, earthquake is even more difficult. It's over so fast. I mean, before you know it, it's all over. The idea that earthquakes were generated by the movement along faults, along these planar fractures in the geology that emerged at the end of the 19th century, and then was the established explanation, in particular in the Great San Francisco earthquake in 1906, the movement along the San Andreas Fault was incredibly incredibly clear, because it cut roads and fences, and it was clear there'd been a horizontal movement along it, and that helped confirm that actually it was the breakage of faults that actually caused earthquakes.
And some of that horizontal movement is amazing. Fences that were separated 8 feet horizontally by the movement of the parts of the earth.
Yeah.
The civic denial of the disaster as earthquake, though, is almost shocking to me.
Well, yeah, it's one thing I discovered when I was writing this book, which I myself don't think was general knowledge, is that if you go back to the period around 1900, there was a very strong movement in California, and in fact across the whole U.S., to really deny that earthquakes were a problem. And I mean, this went as far that there was absolutely no money given by any state or federal agency to research earthquakes in that same period, in the last decades of the 19th century, the first decades of the new century, because it was thought that if you started researching earthquakes, it would imply that there was an earthquake problem, and actually people were so keen at encouraging the growth of the cities and the arrival of new immigrants to California. They didn't want to do anything to discourage people, and it took until the 1930s really before the region accepted that actually earthquakes did happen, that you had to research them, and most importantly, that there were things you could do to prevent them being really destructive. That if you built buildings well, then you could actually prevent them killing people. And it took until then before you started getting official government money to support earthquake research.
But building buildings well is a different story depending on what the prevailing conditions can be where you are. And this is where we get into the Three Little Pigs as a fable of risk management. Was this originally meant as a kid's story, or was it meant to be a risk management tale?
Well, no, I tell the story in the book about the story of the Three Little Pigs, which was actually written in England in the 1830s. I assume that this story was sort of very, very old, but it's actually not. And it's if you don't know it, it's the story of the three little pigs, one who builds the house out of straw, another one out of sticks, and another one out of bricks. And the big bad wolf comes along and blows down the straw on the stick house, but can't blow down the brick house. And eventually the pig in the brick house ends up eating the wolf. But the wolf is clearly meant to be the windstorms that you get every few winters in England, which it sounds like you were about to get in the coast of Oregon last week. But so it makes complete sense if you're concerned about windstorms, it makes huge sense that you don't live in a house built out of straw or sticks. You live in a brick house, so that way you'll do well. Unfortunately, this story became transferred to places like California and Japan, and the Victorian British were very keen on exporting brick construction everywhere, and they started building brick buildings in San Francisco, for example. And it took until some earthquakes before people realized that actually brick is the most dangerous thing to build houses out of in earthquake country. And this story, The Three Little Pigs, doesn't make any sense. It's completely the wrong way around. In a way, you should rewrite it for earthquake country, in which the pig that builds a house out of sticks is the one which is going to do best, because the one that has built his house out of bricks, that brick house has fallen down on the pig by then.
Right. It is different things in different places. It sounds like builders in Constantinople got the idea of what to build for where they were right a long time ago. How did they approach their building?
Well, I mean, I was trying to trace back this question about who first of all, who and where knew how to build houses which actually could withstand earthquake shaking. And it seems it was back in the city of Constantinople, which is very, very earthquake hit city. And back in the 16th century, I mean, you know, this is modern Istanbul in Turkey. And it seems that the city had been hit by the biggest earthquake of the past few hundred years, and lots and lots of big stone buildings had collapsed. And they realized that actually the key was to go and learn from the boat builders. If you had a boat builder construct your house, because when you're making a boat, you make it out of wooden planks, but you've got to make the planks lock together in a way which gives the structure a lot of strength and stability when it gets hit by the waves. So if you handed over the job of building buildings to boat builders, they would build you earthquake-resistant houses. And that's more or less what they did in Istanbul, in Constantinople. They applied the techniques of using triangles of wood, what we call half timbering, with boards on the inside, and they made buildings which were very earthquake-proof. The only problem with this, and this emerged through time, was if you make a building out of wood and wooden planks, it has a tendency to catch fire. And actually, these wooden cities would occasionally suffer massive conflagrations and huge areas would burn down. And then you have to decide, are you going to build your house out of wood or out of stone? Because if you do it out of stone, you're at risk from the earthquakes. If you build it out of wood, you're at risk from the fires.
So it certainly takes some care to make plans for the kinds of disasters that can hit where you are. But is part of the problem, Robert, that people don't like to think about disasters, like they don't like to plan their own funerals?
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly that. I mean, and I think it's sort of interesting why there's still a great belief that we should suppress the information about disasters. I mean, I contrast the fact that we record the names of all those who died in the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, who were as innocent people as the people who died in the earthquake and fire in San Francisco in 1906. But there's no memorial to the earthquake and fire in San Francisco, and it's only fairly recently that you start finding that people think it's appropriate to put up a memorial to a disaster, and that's a problem, because it means that's another way in which we suppress the information and cease to learn from it.
A lot of compelling history and lessons that we have, and in some cases have not learned from, in Robert Muir Wood's book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.